Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping into the world of advanced materials. Really fascinating stuff. We're looking at a specific titanium alloy, Ti6Al4V. You see it everywhere, aerospace, medical implants, high-performance cars. It's kind of a superstar material. Amazing strength, doesn't corrode easily, and the body accepts it well, which is critical for implants. But making complex parts out of it the old way, that's tough. Casting, forging, they have limitations, especially for tricky designs. Lots of extra work afterwards, too. So that brings us to additive manufacturing, or AM. It's changing the game, offering incredible design freedom. And one specific AM method, electron beam melting EBM, is particularly interesting for this Ti6Al4V alloy. Today, we're digging into a really interesting research paper that explores this. It's all about how the EBM process settings affect the final part's strength and behavior. We'll guide you through what they found and what it means for engineers and designers using this tech. Okay, so let's unpack this a bit. This Ti6Al4V, what makes it so vital in engineering today, and where do those traditional methods fall short?
Right. Well, Ti6Al4V, often just called Ti6-4, it's an alpha-beta titanium alloy. Its biggest draw is probably the strength-to-weight ratio. It's incredibly strong for how light it is.
Which is perfect for planes, right?
Exactly. Aerospace loves it. But also, that corrosion resistance is key for harsh environments and biocompatibility. That makes it the gold standard for implants, you know, hip joints, dental fixtures. Now, conventional methods like casting or forging, they're fine for simpler shapes.
Mm.
But if you need really complex internal structures, maybe custom lattice designs for implants or intricate cooling channels, that's where traditional methods get really difficult or super expensive or sometimes just, well, impossible.
Okay, so complexity is the big hurdle. How does additive manufacturing and specifically EBM overcome that for Ti6-4? How does it unlock those designs?
It really is a totally different approach.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of removing material or forcing it into shape, you're building it up, layer by tiny layer, directly from a 3D model.
Like 3D printing, but with metal powder and a powerful beam.
Precisely. And EBM is particularly suited for Ti6-4. It uses a high-energy electron beam, not a laser, inside a high vacuum.
Why the vacuum?
That's critical for titanium.
Oh.
Titanium is very reactive with oxygen, especially at high temperatures. The vacuum prevents contamination, keeps the material pure. Another key thing about EBM is the temperature control. The build chamber is kept hot, usually around 600 to 750 degrees Celsius.
That seems really hot.
It is, but it's deliberate. It means the part cools down relatively slowly after each layer is melted. And crucially, as new hot layers are added on top, they effectively heat treat, or anneal, the layers below.
Like a built-in stress relief step.
Exactly. It significantly reduces residual stresses in the final part, which can be a major problem with other metal AM processes, leading to warping or cracking.
So these unique EBM conditions, the heat, the vacuum, the slow cooling, how does that actually change the internal structure, the microstructure of the titanium itself?
It has a profound effect. As the metal melts and solidifies layer by layer, you tend to get these large, elongated grains forming what we call columnar prior beta grains. They usually grow upwards in the build direction.
Okay.
Then, because of that slow cooling inside the hot chamber, this initial beta phase transforms into a different structure, a mix of alpha and beta phases arranged in very fine parallel plates or layers. It's called an alpha-beta lamellar structure.
Lamellar, like little layers within the grains.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And the size of those original beta grains, but especially the thickness of these finer alpha lamps, the tiny plates, which were about 1.5 micrometers thick in the samples in this study, that's incredibly important. These microstructural features directly control the final mechanical properties, strength, ductility, how tough the material is. It all ties back to that fine lamellar structure. Generally, finer is better.
Right. Makes sense. But even with the process as advanced as EBM, you mentioned it's not always perfect. What kind of defects or flaws can still creep in when making these T6L4V parts?
Yeah, achieving 100% perfect density is the goal. But reality often involves small imperfections. We see a few common types. There's porosity. This can be tiny spherical gas pores, maybe from gas trapped in the original powder, usually pretty small, less than 100 microns. Or you can get larger, but still roughly spherical, pores called keyhole pores. Those usually mean the energy input was a bit too high, causing some instability in the melt pool.
Okay, so mostly small, roundish holes.
Often, yes. But then there's a more problematic one, lack of fusion. This isn't a nice round pore. It's irregular, often elongated. It happens when the powder doesn't fully melt and bond to the layer beneath it.
That sounds not good.
It isn't. It's a major concern. And finally, you also have surface roughness. The outside surface isn't perfectly smooth due to how the melt pool behaves, the layering effect, sometimes called the staircase effect, and powder particles sticking to the sides.
So for you, the engineer listening, why do these tiny flaws matter so much? How do they affect how a part actually performs, say, under load?
They have a huge impact. Porosity, even the small stuff, will reduce the stiffness, the elastic modulus, and the ultimate strength. It can also make the material less ductile, meaning it breaks sooner without stretching much. But, and this is really critical, those lack of fusion defects, they are far more damaging than simple pores of the same size.
Why is that?
Because of their irregular shape. They act like pre-existing cracks. They concentrate stress intensely at their sharp edges, making the material much weaker, especially under tension or fatigue. And surface roughness, while it's on the outside, can be the starting point for fatigue cracks, significantly shortening the life of a component that experiences repeated loads. There are models, like the Gibson and Ashby model for cellular solids, that basically link the relative density, how much solid material versus voids you have, directly to mechanical properties. Lower density means lower performance. Simple as that.
Okay, so density is key, and lack of fusion is particularly bad. What about the direction you build the part? Does printing it standing up versus lying flat change things too?
It absolutely can, and often does. This is called anisotropy. Because the material is built layer by layer, its internal structure often has a preferred orientation linked to that build direction. Those columnar grains we talked about, for instance. This means properties like tensile strength or toughness might be different if you pull on the part parallel to the build direction compared to pulling perpendicular to it.
So another layer of complexity to consider.
Definitely. Especially if defects are present, their orientation relative to the load direction can make a massive difference. Ignoring anisotropy can lead to unexpected failures.
Right. So knowing all this, the material, the EBM process, the potential defects and anisotropy, how did these researchers actually set up their experiments to get clear answers?
They were very systematic. They used a standard EBM machine, an Arkham A2X, under vacuum, as you'd expect for titanium. A key detail is they preheated the powder bed to 700 degrees Celsius before starting the melt. This helps manage thermal gradients and reduce stress, like we discussed. And they kept some things constant. The layer thickness was always 50 micrometers, and the hatch spacing, how far apart the electron beam passes are, was 0.1 millimeters. Standard stuff, really, to provide a baseline.
Okay, so they controlled the basics. What were the key things they changed to see the effects?
They focus on two main variables. First was the process parameters, which they controlled to achieve different levels of energy input, specifically volumetric energy density, or VED. They created four distinct batches labeled A, B, C, and D, each made with a different VED. Batch A had the highest energy density, 39.7 joules per cubic millimeter, and it went down progressively to batch D, which had the lowest at just 10.0 JLML.
How did they adjust the VED? Changing beam power, speed.
Exactly. They varied parameters like beam velocity and beam current to hit those target VED values. Higher VED generally means more energy going into melting the powder. The second main variable was build orientation. They made standard tensile test samples, shaped like dog bones. Half of them were built lying flat, so their long axis was horizontal, perpendicular to the build direction. The other half were built standing up, vertically, with their long axis parallel to the build direction.
Ah, so they could pull on them in line with the layers or across the layers.
Precisely. That allowed them to test for that anisotropy effect under tensile loading.
And once they had these samples built four different ways, with two orientations each, how did they look inside? How did they measure the structure in those defects?
They used a few techniques. X-ray diffraction, XRD, just to confirm they had the expected alpha plus beta crystal structure. Then optical microscopy was crucial. They'd cut and polish samples. Sometimes they'd etch them with a chemical, Keller's reagent, to reveal the grain structure, those alpha lasts we talked about. Other times, they'd examine the polished surface without etching to clearly see the defects, the pores, the lack of fusion areas.
And they measured these defects.
Yes, and this was a key part of the study. They didn't just look, they quantified. They used image analysis, actually writing custom Python code with a library called OpenCV. This code measured the area of each defect, its size, using something called a ferret diameter, its circularity, which tells you how close to a perfect circle it is.
So a lack of fusion defect would have low circularity.
Exactly. It would be irregular. And they also measured the aspect ratio, which indicates how elongated it is. This quantitative data on the defects was vital for explaining the results.
Okay, the stage is set. Meticulous experiment. So what did they find? What did the tensile tests and all that analysis reveal about how these Tysix L4V samples behaved?
The results were really clear, especially regarding the volumetric energy density. Batch A, the one made with the highest VED.
That was 39.7 JLMF.
Right. That batch performed the best. It showed the highest strength and good ductility, good elongation before breaking. Its properties were actually very similar to Ti 6-4 made by conventional forging. Mm-hmm. And crucially, the image analysis showed batch A had very few defects. The defect area fraction was tiny, like 0.015 to 0.12%. What defects it did have were mostly those small circular gas pores.
So high energy density equals good parts. What about the others?
As the VED decreased through batches B, C, and down to D, the defect percentage just soared. Batch D, with the lowest VED, had defect areas between roughly 20 and 25%.
Wow, a quarter of the material is just voids.
Essentially, yes. Largely lack of fusion defects. And as those defects increased, the mechanical properties plummeted. Strengths dropped off significantly with each step down of VED. Batch D was, frankly, very weak.
Okay, so VED is clearly critical for density and strength. What about the build direction? Did printing horizontally versus vertically make a difference? This is the anisotropy question.
Here's a really key finding. For batch A, the good stuff, the dense material, the build direction didn't make a significant difference.
So if you make it properly, it's strong whichever way you pull it.
Pretty much, yes. The horizontal and vertical samples from batch A had very similar strength and elongation. That's great news for designers. If you nail the process parameters to get dense parts, you get basically isotropic behavior.
Okay, but what about the batches with all the defects, B, C, and D?
That's where it got really interesting, and anisotropy kicked in big time. For the defective samples, the build orientation mattered a lot. Consistently, the vertically built samples, the ones loaded parallel to the build direction, were significantly weaker than their horizontally built counterparts. So sample BV was weaker than BH, CV weaker than CH, and DV weaker than DH.
Why? Why would pulling along the build direction be worse when you have defects?
This is where the defect shape and orientation, revealed by that image analysis, became crucial. Remember those lack of fusion defects?
The irregular, nasty ones.
Exactly. When they looked at cross-sections cut parallel to the build direction, which corresponds to the loading direction in the vertical samples, these defects appeared elongated, with low circularity and low aspect ratio. They were oriented like sharp-edged flaws roughly aligned with the direction of pull.
Like little stress risers pointed right where the load is highest.
Precisely. These irregular shapes, with their sharp corners, act as much more severe stress concentrators compared to pulling across them, or compared to pulling on a round pour. So when the load was applied parallel to these elongated defects in the vertical samples, they initiated failure at much lower stresses.
That makes sense. The shape and alignment were critical. And what did the breaking pieces look like? Did the fracture surfaces confirm this?
Yes. The scanning electron microscope, the SEM analysis of the fracture surfaces, told a very consistent story. Batch A, the good batch, showed ductile fracture features lots of dimples, indicating plastic deformation before failure. This was true for both orientations, though the horizontal ones sometimes showed signs of layers delaminating slightly. For batches B and C, the difference was clear. The vertical samples showed fracture surfaces where the crack clearly ran through the large lack of fusion defects. You'd see smooth areas, which were the original defect surface, mixed with some ductile dimpled areas. But the horizontal samples from B and C still showed larger areas of ductile dimples and delamination, suggesting more energy was absorbed before failure, even with defects present, because the load wasn't hitting those defects edge-on in the same way.
And batch D, the really defective one.
Batch D was striking. The fracture surface was almost entirely smooth, corresponding directly to those huge lack of fusion areas, and even some unmelted powder particles stuck there. There were very few dimples.
Meaning it basically just snapped right through the existing defects?
Exactly. It showed there was a very small actual load-bearing area. It failed in a very brittle-like manner at extremely low stress, which perfectly matches the tensile test results.
Wow. What a detailed picture, from process settings to microstructure to defects, and finally to how the part actually breaks. It really connects all the dots.
It does. It clearly shows that VED is a master variable for controlling density and strength in EBM Ti6AL4V.
So bringing it all together for the listener, what are the main takeaways here?
Okay, I think there are two crucial points. First, if you use a sufficiently high volumetric energy density with EBM, you could produce Ti6-4 parts that are dense, strong, and essentially isotropic. Their properties are great and don't depend much on build direction, comparable to traditional methods.
That's the ideal scenario.
Right. But second, if your VED is too low, you will get defects, especially lack of fusion. And when those defects are present, the build direction becomes critically important. Loading parallel to elongated lack of fusion defects drastically reduces strength. So for defective parts, anisotropy is a major factor.
So for you, the engineer, this means you need to control that energy input carefully. Get it right, and you have design freedom. Get it wrong, and you need to be very aware of how the part is built and how it will be loaded.
Absolutely. Understanding this relationship allows for much better optimization of EBM processes for critical parts. It helps push the reliable use of additive manufacturing for these high-performance alloys.
And it leads to safer, more reliable components in really demanding applications.
Definitely.
Now, here's a final thought to leave you with. The paper mentions this work is part of a bigger project. They're aiming to use machine learning to build models that automatically correlate process parameters, microstructure, defects, and final properties.
Yeah, imagine that.
Imagine feeding your desired properties into an AI, and it tells you the exact EBM settings needed to achieve them, predicting defect formation and accounting for anisotropy automatically. What could we design and build then?
That would be a huge leap forward for advanced manufacturing. Really exciting potential.
Something to ponder. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive today. We'll catch you next time.